Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Explicit Measures Podcast with Tommy, Seth, and Mike. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Here we go. Another day, another dollar. Jumping in. So a couple good announcements here. But before we do announcements today, we're going to talk about today a feature of Fabric called the Synaptic Link.
So semantic.
Semantic link, I meant to say. I'm literally looking at the word and saying, and adding a Y to it. So
the synapses in your brain are,
oh boy,
are not firing all together yet.
Needs to be more coffee before I do this. Oh, yeah, yay. So semantic link, being able to connect to the semantic model, linking that to notebooks and the experiences you can derive from there. Really, a lot of interesting blogs have been kind of coming out about this. And I think this is a great feature. It's a library you can use in notebooks, but we'll talk about that in a moment. That's going to be our main topic for today. Let's jump into some news items here. So a couple news items that have come across our radar in the last couple of days. One, these are going to be in the description. This is a recorded episode for those who are jumping in, but the links will be in the description. We're talking about one here from, let's see if I can catch the name of the author, William Krieger, I think is the name. And William is talking about talking through capacities and doing a comparison, I believe is how I read this, two workloads, the same workload, one is done in a pipeline, the second is done in Spark notebooks. So basically comparing how many compute units are taken to use or do a simple or a data transformation or some kind of data engineering activity. So it's the same activity, but it's just being done twice, which I find very interesting. He also goes in the very beginning of the article, he talks a lot about the ability to take the capacity units, the CUs, and turn them into dollars. So you can use some, you know, back of the napkin math to get into this number of CUs is available to us in a given month. How much does it cost me to run this pipeline in this notebook for this thing? It can literally be turned into a dollar amount. So he actually goes through in the very beginning of the article, it talks through how many dollars per hour the capacity costs you, either reserve or non-reserved pricing. And then he goes through the math of saying, look, here's how to calculate a capacity unit and how many capacity units per hour you get. So essentially the thought here is if you, every capacity unit, you're getting 320,000 capacity units per hour, and then you can use that, divide by your cost per hour, and then you get a cost per CU per hour, and then you can then go multiply that by how many CUs in total were being consumed. So basically, you can back your way into a dollar amount on whatever those costs are doing. He also makes it a very clear point: using reserved capacity is much cheaper. So he's doing running the same capacity. You go from like $45 down to $27, depending on what, you know, how many CUs you're using, but the reserve capacity definitely drops your pricing. So if you can plan out consistent loads on your capacities and go buy some reserve capacity pricing and add that to your solution, that will give you a discount on top of those Fabric SKUs you're purchasing.
Getting most for your money. That's a good thing.
I'd agree.
I love this article. Yeah. Okay.
No, I think you addressed it. I don't know if you like did it in your good summary here, Mike, but you've pushed off on the topic earlier where, you know, companies, we've talked about the challenges sometimes of the new things in Fabric, the new mm-hmm. ways to do stuff. There's so much more that's going to be introduced to the business, and are they going to explore it to the degree that, you know, they could? And the answer, I think in some of our previous podcasts, is like, no, there's no expectation that one individual is going to learn all this stuff. However, if a business goes, like, uses articles like these and says, I'm sorry, you're telling me we could rebuild our things and have 5x less processing and increase the longevity of the current capacity we're on? Well, now that's a net cost-saving exercise.
100%.
For resources that I have.
Yep.
Go learn it, right? Yes. Right now it becomes part of the job because there are new things that are going to open these doors for different patterns that that folks aren't familiar with.
So in this article, which I also really appreciate here, to your point, Seth, there's a great little visual that he builds. Here's a visual. Here is some information on the visual. And he basically has a very consistent report page that goes through the comparison of a notebook orchestration versus a pipeline orchestration, a copy activity inside a pipeline versus a copy activity in a notebook. So he's going through some other items here. And the initial results on what he says, and again, I like where we're going. I want a little bit more other engineers, other people to confirm the results. I need a third party confirmation of results here. But basically, the general pattern here is things that are occurring inside the pipeline are about 4x more expensive in compute units than it is in Spark doing the same thing. So he has some simple pipelines. For example, like get a list, execute a pipeline. Now the pipeline sets a path, it does a copy, populate the data. So like there's a store procedure running. So he's doing some things inside that. Like he's trying to make a bit of a load on there. And I think a lot of this will be, it depends on what kind of activities you're doing, right? If you're running an SSIS package inside a pipeline, that's probably going to be a bit different of an expense than just running a copy paste and just moving data around. So this idea of, or the challenge, I guess I would say, is how are we going to, as engineers, look at these different designed architectures? Here's what I'm doing in a pipeline. Yes, for sure we can do it in a Spark notebook, but can we guarantee the amount of savings and CU that we need to make the transformation from one to the other? Anyways, I found this very interesting. I kind of knew this in the back of my head, you know, running a pipeline versus running data flow versus running a Spark notebook will not have the same compute unit per job that you're running. So it's going to be really important that you kind of, if you have big projects with long running activities, it probably would be worthwhile your time to figure out which compute engine is the most efficient doing that job. Now, it will take you a little bit more design time up front. Over time, I think there's going to be more articles. People will continue to like explain this a bit more in detail. And we'll get to a place where, okay, we can generally say there's some more general rule of thumb things. Oh, a pipeline's like 2x more expensive than a this, that, and the other thing. A data flow will be the most expensive because of XYZ things. Like there'll be probably be some general guidelines you can go after. But I'm very encouraged that the Spark experience is fast and uses few CUs because that's the experience that I like to use.
Right. The assumption, though, is the delta here is pretty significant. So the kind of the wide assumption would be, we should just move everything or as much as we can to Spark notebooks. But that's not always the case. And I think
don't know yet.
Yeah,
right. I wouldn't be so firm in that statement.
Right.
I would be we don't know. We need more testing is what I would say. But it's looking promising that potentially you could save compute units and do 3 times, 4 times more work in a Spark notebook without paying extra money.
It's not extra money that you're like.
I see what you're saying.
It's capacity time.
Yes,
right?
Correct.
Like you're paying for like the different models between
the cost systems. Doesn't change.
One, right. One is this would be saving direct cost because time is money because you're using
correct.
Like pay as you go.
Correct.
Like the FSKU is a little bit different take on that where you're incurring a cost for the capacity that does many different types of workloads. And this is a cost saving measure. In the perspective that you're not utilizing as much capacity, so
correct.
There's more capacity to do other things.
Correct.
Which means you're going to extend the life of how long you can live on that existing capacity while continuing to develop new patterns, new processing, and things. So there is a net, but it's even more important to understand these nuances, like are outlined in this article, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there is that. You're going to hit that point at which the decision is, man, things are slowing down. Do we beef up the capacity? What's taking the most like usage? What's
correct.
Using the most of our capacity during certain timeframes? And analysis of that, like this does, will highlight those areas of potential performance improvement, right? So if you're mm-hmm. rolling into an FSKU and everything is not using Spark capacities, there mm-hmm. might be a huge opportunity to say, wow, okay, well, somebody's going to ramp up. We're going to take on this load, but the potential longevity of, you know, moving all our pipelines is we could extend this same capacity for another year or two. I mean, that's a big deal. It's worth the investment.
And I'll tell you what, even more now, thank goodness for folders in workspaces.
Oh my goodness. Tell me about it.
The amount of more notebooks that you need. It's been so nice having folders. And yeah, I don't care if it's in beta forever or public preview. I'm using them.
100%. I agree with you. 100%. And they're cheap. Yes, agree. But to your point, though, Tommy, like if you're doing this kind of testing, I mean, this is these are the kind of things, you know, and again, I'm also thinking I'm very pro on, hey, we're going to bring a bunch of business users into Fabric. That's what's coming. Right. Those are the users that are coming now currently. There may be more data engineers and data scientists future stepping into this. But right now, it's a lot of business users. So we're going to be comfortable with Power. We're going to be comfortable with data flows. That's what we're going to be comfortable with. I think we'll have an easy migration path into pipelines because that will help us simplify some things. But eventually, there will be points where, okay, I'm comfortable with those two experiences. Now I'm ready to start learning some notebooks. I'm going to go a bit more technical on that side. And I've found a lot of people, shockingly, I've been talking to clients, like, yeah, I used to do Python a long time ago, but I don't do it now. Well, great. I've got a wonderful experience for you. Like, can you write SQL? Yeah, we can write SQL statements. Great. Getting to Python and doing things there is not too far. It's definitely different. But I say it's not too far away from writing like lines of code and understanding how to read the code and interpret it. So if you can rock your head around using SQL, yeah. I think you still need to learn some things, but it's the jump or gap between that and what you're doing in Python is not too far.
Yeah. And I think the cost thing is a big part for me. Not to segue too much to the article, but I'm one of those people who is from the peer Power BI Pro analyst and a few years back started learning Python, also notebooks, got a Raspberry Pi, set up Jupyter Hub on it. And yeah, there's a learning curve, but to other episodes we've had, guess what? There's also this thing called Copilot.
That does a lot of things for you. Helps out a lot.
Yeah. Granted, that's another cost. That's not on top of this, but.
Granted, that's also, again.
Yeah.
So to our talking point earlier, right, there's going to be a line item for Copilot on a workspace on how much that's being utilized, right? Now you can back your way into a cost for that feature to be turned on in your tenant.
Yeah.
So this article, again, kind of illuminates more of like, what is the implication of those costs? To your point, Seth, if I'm using CU on Copilot, I'm not using that CU to render a report, to run a pipeline, to do another thing. So that is distinctly pulling away from our normal experience. So that's where it's interesting to see how this is going to play out. I wish the Copilot experience was a little bit lower in the F SKUs. I mean, it doesn't have to be at an F2 level, especially when you're using Power BI Desktop. It would be nice to turn on, you know, an F2 and have Copilot work with my desktop because all I'm doing in desktop is asking for things to help me build stuff. So maybe a couple builders get a smaller SKU where they're allowed to share the capacity to run Copilot.
Be out in 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We'll see anyways, I like the article. I thought it was good. Thought it was worth pointing out. We have one more article here. Seth, I think you found this one. I want to talk a little bit about the visual calculations that you found from Jeffrey Wang and maybe explain who he is and why this is one, important.
Jeffrey is one of the founding people of DAX. He's on the Power BI team, you know, like Jeffrey, I think, and Marco probably talk daily. So
yeah,
regardless, like just a brilliant man and very interesting to always be in the room when he's talking. Ironically enough, it's really difficult to find his articles. So like you got to catch the link. He's got a site, PBI DAX, that he posts out on WordPress. But anyway, I think it probably requires a full episode to start diving into visual calculations, but this is a really big deal that we probably haven't talked about enough of on the podcast yet, and we probably should. So we should probably change that. I'm just kind of brain barfing as I kind of reminisce about like reading through this article really quick. Highly recommend going and reading this because it's the first of many that starts to deconstruct and explain why Microsoft has built in this visual calculations layer into the Power BI Desktop. And it's primarily focused at engaging business users and to get over the hump of learning DAX ultimately, right? Because there's this, you go from Excel, right? Cell by cell formulas, and people become very comfortable with it. Excel's been around for forever and a day. And then you go to this construct in Power BI where it's like, you have this one measure and it's repeatable and you use it everywhere. And we talk about filter context and all these other things. And it, people are like, oh, okay, I get it. How do I create a measure? And it's like, oh, you can do a sum and you can do these things. And it's like this really low barrier of entry. And the business user is like super excited. And they're like, yeah, this is going to be awesome. Okay, now I need to do time intelligence.
Okay.
And it's like your learning curve just went way through the roof.
Yep.
And if I was going to pick one area where it's like this alone kind of proves like visual calculations are awesome and get to learn them, is it just removes the barrier of entry on a visual by visual layer to do these calculations and get the results that you would expect. So how they went about doing this, because it's still all integrated into the semantic model and DAX, et cetera, is what was a phenomenal path to actually kind of be aware of. But this is the first of the blogs or articles that he's going to write, and just gives a really great summary. Like, here's the problem we're trying to solve. Here's why it's really important, and gives an example around time intelligence. So go check it out. Get involved in visual calcs, and you know, bring that into your repertoire of learning, as I am, to start to tell other people about it, because I think it's extremely powerful, especially for the new user within Power BI, but also, and we've seen, I'm going to forget his name right off the top of my head. There's some really cool interactions that can start to happen with objects and functionality within the Power BI report and visual calculations to create some really great new types of experiences that otherwise would just be insanely hard to build with really complex DAX.
I think that's the large impact, right? It really does have a use case and benefit for anyone on the skill scale, right? For new users or for someone who's been doing DAX for a while. I am very intrigued, though, on the focus on the new user, right? So do a lot of dashboard and day trainings, do a lot of introductory trainings. And one of the big things I always iterate when we first introduce DAX is, this is not rocket science. This is not like learning a new coding language. However, this is a conceptual change. And that's the hardest part of DAX, because it's a functional language. It's, you know, sum, calculate, you know, and you filter by something. But it's because it's model to model that really affects everything. And it always depends on the model. And it's the evaluation context. That's the hard part. The functions themselves, not incredibly difficult. But now this introduces almost kind of like you said, like a bit of going past that. So I'm intrigued what you guys think, because I've been pondering this and I've been trying to figure this out myself. When, if you're going to a new user training or onboarding, when do you introduce visual calculations compared to kind of our normal traditional learning pathway?
Well, let me caveat some things here as well. So I'm going to answer your question. I do want to talk a little bit more about the article, because I thought it was a really good example here. There's two tables that are produced towards the bottom of the article. And what Jeffrey does is he says, look, we're going to go look at the internals of the VertiPack engine. What is it doing to the storage engine queries? So what is it doing to go get the data, and how's it returning the data out? And the first example, he has the month of the year and he has a sales number. And then he's doing a year to date sales across that year period of time. So you have a normal, just simple summing of a column, whatever the month total was. And then next to that, he has the cumulative total, which is generally, when you are talking about expensive queries, the ones that are expensive are cumulative ones. So if you're doing stuff with cumulative sums on things, those get really expensive back to the query engine. So this is a pattern that Microsoft has observed. Apparently he talks in the article, there are many patterns that can be solved in unique and visual calculation ways. But this is one where the cumulative, the year-to-date sales is one that solves that. So he shows you the original table with the original DAX, and it shows you there are four queries to run the entire table. And these are all being run against back to the engine. So all those four queries are taking time. They're costing you compute units to render the report. So it's going to slow down things. Then he does the same thing again. And he says, here's the same example, but this time my year-to-date sales is now going to be calculated using a sum or using a visual calculation. Same numbers, same result, but now everything can be rendered as a single query. It's one query back to the storage engine. And we know the storage engine is where the expense comes from when we're doing queries against the engine model, because that's it's physically saying, I need to go get the data from the stored portion of the model, calculate things and bring it back out. So I think the example to your point, Tommy, so answering your question, when do we use visual calculations? I still think this is an area where we're going to have to figure out where's the best place to do this. It would be nice, and this is my opinion here, it'd be nice if Microsoft could identify these patterns for me based on the formulas that I'm going to be using, right? There are year-to-date calculations that will need to be run. So from my standpoint, it would be nice if the visual gave you a little warning symbol and said, hey, this visual is using a pattern that we could generate inside a visual calculation. If you change this from what you are doing to a visual calculation, it will go faster. So I don't know if they can automatically do that yet, or if there's just, you need to notify the users about this, but this is one of these are one of these nuances, Tommy, like where it's going to be like, if you know what you're doing, you can make it faster and more efficient. If you don't, you won't know any different. You won't. So,
or you're just incurring technical debt.
Well, the other trick or challenge I'm seeing here, I think here is, you know, when you're, I love the idea of visual calculations. I still have hesitation because those are stored in the visual. I can query them through other processes, but they're not part of the main data model, which probably is fine. But I have to be aware that if I'm going to use a year-to-date sales calculation, I can only use it on that single visual. And if I need to repeat it across multiple visuals, I think I need to copy-paste the visual to other places, and that would then keep the calculation with it. But now, as a designer, as a governance person, I'm a little bit more worried because now I could have multiple people doing things to visual calculations that it starts shifting how that definition of that thing looks.
Yeah.
So
it would definitely be one of those things that as... you know, when we talk about report certification or like as an audience grows, like you would say, hey, you know, I see what we're doing this thing multiple times across these pages. We're going to simplify that. We're going to create this one tax measure. That's what's going to be showing up. Or we're using, we have multiple reports on a model and those are all going, right? Like we're going to certify the data set. Like that's where I would say like that would make sense to do a conversion, but you would know that you could do it. It's just one more thing to check on the box.
A bit of irony there because probably a lot of those metrics are probably business metrics that need to live in the model because it's part of the business. It's not, right?
But at the same time, like the barrier to entry though, right? You're lowering that bar. And I think that's vastly important for expansion of business users to get the most out of Power BI right out of the gate without needing help.
I agree. And I think this is also a pattern, like, you know, Marco Russo was very pro, like, let's figure out how to do visual calculations. Cause I'm also thinking here too, right? If you want to do things like spark lines, if you want to do things like other fancy visual based things inside the context of the visual there. So in my mind, there's this delineation between there are things that belong in the model that are going to service many reports, and there are things that are going to service styling, featured a bit like the single visual, right? So if there are visual aspects that are just styled or DAX that I'm writing to stylize that particular visual, conditional formatting, visual calculations, things like that, then those should stay inside the report context because I don't need to share them across other reports. And so how do you identify that? What does that look like? I would err on the side of, you know, I like to have my main model simple because then it's easier for people to understand. It's easier for people to build stuff on it. You don't have to be as organized with lots of folders. I'm doing things now in my models where I'm saying, here are my quote unquote base calculations. Yeah. And if I'm carrying special other calculations, like, hey, I need to return instead of a null value, I need to return some text that's like dash dash, right? That can be very expensive if you put it in a table, but not very expensive if you put it in a card. So in some cases, I'm now building other folders of measures that are like, these are visual-based calculations, or these are ones that are formatting. I'm taking the same sum, but I'm doing some additional formatting on top of it that's producing a different result. So I'm keeping both measures, the one to do the sum and the one that do the formatting contextually as well, returning a dash or a number, but I'm making them very specifically different and naming them and putting them in different folders. So I know that these calculations are more visual centric and where they should be used. Don't use these calculations inside a table. Use these on KPI cards. Like, that's what those are for. So sometimes you have these very specific designed,
right,
styled measures for style things. And I don't know if these all should exist inside the main model.
Yeah. I mean, to answer your question, just spitballing, I would, if I'm teaching new people, I'm teaching the foundations of tabular models and DAX first and why they're important, because it's the same conversation we're having right now. It's fully extensible. Is it complicated? Some of these measures are complicated.
Yes.
But they're fully extensible in any number of reports that the model touches, right? That's the value behind them. So, but it also, like, what I would perceive as a great handoff point would be, you know, that conversation is, here's the simple stuff. Now, let me show you, like, one of the most useful things in DAX, and you freak them out with, like, the time intelligence one.
Yep.
And then you're like, but here's an easy path to get you started. Visual calcs, right? So they now, like, I think it's important to ingrain the value of why you would build it in a DAX measure in the model itself versus a visual calculation, but then, like, really highlight, like, you guys can continue right now getting value easily in a more easily digestible format on a visual by visual basis. Go at it, right? But as you're learning, yep, Here's where you still want to shoot for, because it's more extensible, yeah, right? It's more about, like, but that's just me.
No, I
feel you led the other way.
This, yeah.
Then people are like, oh, great, you just gave me the easy path. I don't need to worry about the more complicated DAX stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you want them to learn that.
Yeah.
So I
like that.
I do want to make a point of clarification. So, like, I slaughtered the intro of Jeffrey. Jeffrey has been with Microsoft for 20 years. He's a partner architect and has been working on DAX programming language and that team in memory days for that long. So that's why he is held in pretty high esteem.
So I want to say, so I like this conversation here, particularly around this latter part of the visual calculations piece of this. In my mind, I'm going to, you know, take out my mind's eye here and look at this big picture scenario here, right? If I think about what's going on in these reports, there's no tooling that exists today that allows you to scan the model and all the associated reports and, one, see all the visual calculations that are listed inside those reports. Because, again, if you change a core calculation and that's using a visual calc as the visual calc is using those core calculations, it will change things. So, and this is also the same challenge with visual measures that are inside the thin reports, which also can happen too, which is not bad. My thinking here is, there is no which measures are most similar. Like, so if I think about my organization and things that I want to govern, I want to have the ability to say, look, here's 20 models. What's kind of similar across the models? What kind of tables are we using? What kind of columns are named, what they are, what's unique, what's not unique. I actually, in my mind, I'm thinking it'd be really nice to have the Venn diagram of the common elements across those models. At least I can see it, right? Because stuff's going to happen. People are going to build things. It's just going to occur. In the certified stuff, I'm hoping that we have plans and documentation that helps support this already. But when there's a lot of self-service, you don't know. So, right.
Yeah.
And then add to that now the visual reports, add to that now visual calculations. And now we've gone two steps deeper into the design process of what things we want to be building. And this is where I get a lot of, like, this is where my mind goes. We built DAX.Power BI tips because we were thinking there is common DAX things that should be reused over and over again. There's a spark line. I'm going to do a star rating, 1, 2, 3, or 4. I'm going to do... There's common patterns that I think that people or DAX things that people have built that they want to reuse. This is the same thing that Marco Russo did in SQL BI, where they're saying, you know, DAX patterns. There's literally a book of just showing you, here are patterns you should know how to do, because those patterns will occur over and over again. I want a library of all these patterns at the visual calculation level, at the thin report level and at the model level. And what should be happening is you should be having your smartest people in DAX on your team building the pattern that we're going to use, producing that pattern to the organization. And so when I'm in a report, it should no longer be, I need to write the DAX. It should be, I know I need this DAX here.
Yeah, but it's still, they still have to understand the concept. They still have to understand the concepts of what it's doing and whatnot. Like, so I agree with you. That would be helpful. But like where my mind goes is, okay, how much easier is it now for Copilot to recommend what the measure should be when somebody actually builds it in the Visual Calc and says, yep, this is what I want.
And I'm not so worried about that. I mean, I don't know. Can you do annotations? Is there a way you can annotate a measure? I know you can annotate tables and other things. I'm not sure if annotations work there. But the reason why I'm saying these things is because the tooling has gotten much better for us to decompress what's inside these reports and the models, and it's all code-based. So semantic link is where I'm kind of going with this. Yeah. This is a great transition moment because you can run additional DAX against the models. I don't think you can the reports yet, but you can run DAX against a model to spit out either tables of data information from there, or you can actually go in and get information about the model. Here are all the measures and their definitions. So I very easily could see here in the future where we're saying throw 15 models at this semantic link, and the semantic link will then be able to read all those models and spit out details that we could then do analysis on later. Are there calculations that are named the same? What is the difference in those calculations or not? And you can then figure out how to address or govern more things later on. So I think this is a good point to transition from what we were talking about, which was visual calculations, into now, what is semantic link? Tommy, I think you've done some work in semantic link. You want to kind of start us off with a kind of an initial definition of semantic link stuff?
Semantic link is a Python library or a Python package that's available in Fabric notebooks that actually allows you to treat a semantic model as a data set that's commonly used, or a data frame. We can now evaluate, pull data, models, tables, and measures, and make that our own data frame. And we can choose what we want from semantic links. We can do the DMV views, dynamic management views. And then we can push that to other places, treat it as a common data frame. Anything you can do in a data frame now, anything you can do in a Jupyter notebook now, you can use that with the semantic model. And there's a large impact here if you've done Jupyter notebooks before, or if you've used this. Normally, what are we dealing with is raw data. Going back to our beginning conversation, I have to do data engineering and clean up or move this data around. Usually, that's just raw data that we're making a data frame. But now I can treat that. I can actually use a semantic link. And for me, that further goes on that kind of path of the semantic model is no longer the end path or the final stop in your destination with Power BI. The extensibility of a semantic model really is impacted and changes here.
So why would a notebook want to pull data? Like, so I'm just thinking like,
yeah,
high level concept here, right? All right. I've made a semantic model. I've published it out. There's data in it. We're spending time loading that data, getting it groomed. Like, and there are business users that are using reports that are looking at that model. So we have a similar definition of what's going on there. What is the value of semantic link? What are the use cases of why I'd want to use it inside a notebook? It's not a visual layer. It's not an interactive layer that I would be going through. What are the implications of what this means? I guess is what I'm trying to get to.
I mean, where do you want me to start? So
let's just list one idea. I'm lobbing a softball at you, because there are a lot of use cases for this. I'm just looking for what is one use case, Tommy, that you can think of.
Let's start with taking data science out of it, validation, right? And I think because that's been the common core problem for so many of our conversations around how do we validate our Power BI data,
right?
I want data quality. Okay.
I want to hang on this. Yeah. So okay. Don't go to the next topic. I think this is the one I was like, I was thinking the same thing on this one. I like this one. I'm vibing with you on this one.
Down, yeah.
So let me give you a scenario of what happens. And I think this does occur maybe varying degrees in your organization, right? I build a semantic model. We develop it. We put it into dev. dev has a different data set than other environments, but in the dev environment, I'm able to push the model and I can see the model bringing in data, doing its aggregations, and then I know I have a table with a certain dimension, whatever the dimension may be, product, something, and then there's a measure attached to it. The data that is loaded into that model, the sums, the aggregations of those things come to a certain amount. When I go over to test environment, I do the same thing, but now the data set is different. I'm looking at a different database to support that information. And then if I go to production, there's yet another different data set or data source that's supporting that model. In each of those scenarios, I could verify that the partitions or the things that I'm doing down below have the right amount of data in them to give me the total for 2013, right? So my assumption would be is if I know 2013 has data in it and I know from past builds, it's, you know, 1.2 million in sales, I would expect every time I make a new change to that model moving forward, when I take the total of 2013, if that data is expected to exist in there, that number would not change in right. future versions. So there is this concept of data ops or verifying, like I made changes to a model and I have to either incrementally refresh, load some data into it. But as we do this in our process, we want to verify that we captured all the data. Everything's there, right? I didn't miss a partition in loading. Something didn't fail. I'm getting the data that I should be. So as I change the model, I really want like a test that says, yep, the data's there. We loaded it all correctly. We're good to go. Move forward. So I see that as being a valuable effort. And the more you can automate those things, the easier it will be for you to verify that the reports are actually doing what they should be. From a central, again, I'm going to be very clear here. I'm going to lean on this again. If it's self-service stuff, probably not writing tests. If it's central BI and it's certified, probably thinking about what can I do to write tests. So to me, I see Semantic Link being a test writing tool where I can take a copy of old data, save it somewhere as, you know, basically take a readout. Here's some dimensions, here's some aggregations. I'm going to take that information, I'm going to save it into the lakehouse. I'm going to rebuild the model or add things to the model or make changes to the model. And the next time I create a build, the Semantic Link runs, creates the same table with the same dimensions and goes back to verify, okay, against that other table I saved previously, how different are we? Are we the same? Are the numbers identical? Great. Numbers are the same, move on, we're good to go. And I think this occurs a lot more in financial reporting than it does in other areas, just where I've seen it, people talking about this more frequently.
So I'll take your same, I'll take your same example. And even without from the data ops of, like I said, the common core problems we've had from the from business data of, hey, we're expecting 15 sales reps. I'm expecting the measure to be, you know, X, Y, and Z. And that's always been the most difficult thing to do from a testing point of view.
Correct. And so you're building, like what you do right now is you build another report that has a table in it, that has the information, and you're like, okay, I'm going to screenshot that and put it over here. And then I'm going to run the model. I'm going to push it out. And then okay, I'm going to look at the screenshot and I'm going to compare it. Like, so it's a human based process that's comparing one to the, not wrong. If I could do that in a half a second or a couple milliseconds by automating that thing, I could run, that's one test. But what if I want 60 tests? Like that's 60 pages potentially of things you're trying to produce to make sure that the data is coming out consistently. Again, for central BI stuff, I think you don't, again, to be very clear, you don't need to build all tests up front at the beginning. But when you find a problem, that may be an opportunity to spend a little extra time to build a test around this. And John Kursky, who has a blog around all the, I mean, he's on like blog, what, 56, 600 now? I don't know what blog number is, but he's been literally running this series of like, here's why data ops and CI/CD is so important for your organization. It helps with consistency and it helps you build data products that are consistent every time. And I 100% agree and buy into this, into the thinking. Seth, I know you've been mulling on some ideas, so I'm going to pick on you.
No, I agree with you guys. I agree with you guys in terms of verification, but I also like the highest value I see out of this relationship is just the time saving in development. Because and it's ironic to me that, well, we can get into it. I would have flip flopped the article. I would have led with some of the things towards the end and put those front and center.
Oh.
Because one of the biggest challenges we have with, you know, updating or adding something into a model is understanding what the relationships of that model are. And what this is uncovering, yes, is that that lineage that you're talking about,
yes,
is I can look into my model.
Yep.
I can use things like list relationships or plot dependencies and,
yes,
all just instantly get that visual representation of like the model relationship from the model,
yep,
into, you know, a data frame where I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to update this. This is the relationship in there. This is how that's going to impact, you know, the report, et cetera. And it just saves me from having to have the two screen, opening up the Power BI, you know, PBIX file, looking at the, yep, relationships, et cetera. So it's a time saver in that regard. And it, yep, also verifies that, like, yeah, this is designed how I want it to, or to your point, Mike, verify from a environment to environment, right? Like I'm,
yes,
we're making major changes to the model. This is expected. Here's how we're going to do things, whatever.
Agreed.
I'm just doing that double check,
yes,
right in the code that I'm in before I do any deployment. Right.
Oh man, that even goes back to Seth, to our previous article on data, the abnormalities or outliers too. There's a lot of use cases here.
Sure.
To your point, Tommy, though, as well, like, you know, we can only control what we control. And I want to hang on that point you made there, Tommy. I think that's understated what you said, yeah, there. You know, if I'm looking at production data and we're having some sort of production change or issue or whatever.
You're saying the model, not necessarily just the database, well, right?
I'm talking about like the database source, right? So let's say something changed in the data source, right? You're assuming the data for 2023 was not changing, but something went wrong. Something didn't load. Maybe something didn't refresh properly. Again, a lot of times I see inside organizations, there's a lot of trunk reload stuff, yeah, right? Things may change. We don't know what will be changing, but we're going to trunk reload tables of information in production because we're going to stage the data from the source system. We're going to do some transformations to it. We're going to lift it over. So if you're doing that kind of stuff, even so, the report, I can't tell you the number of times I've been in a call like this. Your report's wrong. The report's wrong. Okay, let me go in the report. Well, it looks like the numbers are showing the right net value. Let me go back to the source system. Oh yeah, source system's missing data. What's going on there? Oh yeah, we had a job fail or something didn't load correctly, or we made a change and no one told anyone. It's going to happen. It's there. But if my report's going to C-levels and they're telling me my report's wrong, I'm like, look, I'm just reporting on what data you've presented to me. We've had a lot of discussions with, hey, your data is missing stuff. Like you're literally, there's problems in your data. And the model is just exposing those challenges because you've never, like when you were doing this in Excel, you couldn't find the issue. Now that we're in Power BI, we can see much more data faster and have better aggregations. You're now seeing the problem of your bad data. So this happens. And so I think this will also help us debug things when there are problems with the data solution. Where does this really exist? Is it in the model or potentially it could have been in the source system? Sorry, I didn't mean to hang on that point longer.
I think, like I said, for me, not that some of that wasn't available before with the database, but for me, this impact is, like I said, this elevation or putting the semantic model on the same, basically the same plane as a database in terms of what do you do with the database? You query it, you pull data, and then you know, we're pushing into reports or doing other things with that.
Yep.
And semantic models have always been, till this point, kind of that, again, end road. There's no able external tooling to be able to work on that model. Mm-hmm. So this is a really big impact here. I don't know if you have anything else here, but I think I would love for you to poll our listeners and ask, because I'm assuming out of our 5 listeners that we have or 10 listeners that we have, maybe 3 are experienced with Jupyter Notebooks in Python, right? If this is a Power BI podcast, you know, I would probably put at maybe the 30%. And I think that would be, If I would assume, right?
Tommy, not anymore. Them. We've explored. Anymore. We've been pushing these folks so hard from out of fabric. Like they're all like, I would say it's higher than that.
I'm willing to put some cash down for that. Or
I will. I'm not going to be as specific with numbers because I don't think the numbers are going to be very. I have no way of knowing. Like I'm not talking to everyone who listens to the podcast. All 5 of you, I don't talk to you. So I could do it, but I can't. I don't have enough time. So here's what I would say. Today, what is the size of audience that uses Python notebooks and is comfortable in using them today? I'm going to say minimal. It's going to be smaller, right? But if we look 6 months from now, 1 year from now, I think we're going to see that experience and that audience continue to increase. And one thing that I'm, and here's a data point that I'm using to proxy this by, right? Look at the number of people now communicating about semantic link and, notebooks and experiences, notebooks and testing about notebooks. So like the article we brought out earlier, right? Testing a Spark notebook against a pipeline, doing the same kind of activities, right? In my mind, I'm looking at this going, hey, people are, where the blogs are going are where people's interests are leaning towards. So because this whole notebook experience is brand spanking new, I feel like right now I'm seeing a flurry of like notebook experience-based things that are ramping up. Who's the other gentleman who was, Rui Romano. So Rui was doing a demo at Fabric Conference. His prior demos and most of the stuff that he built, Rui has a monitoring solution that you can use in your organization to monitor your tenant, all built in PowerShell. It was 100% PowerShell.
Yeah.
His new demos are not even using PowerShell. All the new demos are 100% based inside notebooks. So even the Microsoft product team is shifting their workloads away from other tools that could get their job done. They're now moving them into notebooks and experiences there. So that you need the plethora of documentation and experiences first before people feel comfortable reading the blog, following along, and getting into it. And that's why Power BI Tips existed, right? We existed at the beginning to get people building visuals and doing tricks and tips there around the visuals. And, you know, when people started at mass communicating about this, everyone's like, oh, this is interesting. Oh, I'm learning this stuff here. Great. So that barrier to learn these things is going to get less and less and less as more people blog about it. So all that to say, small now, I think it's going to increase larger over time. So this is a good thing to learn because I see a lot of blogs and I think other interest is very, it's high. It's high right now in this area.
I mean,
so quick Tommy, you led with the semantic model or semantic link, making the semantic model not be the end anymore. What do you mean by that? What use cases are you thinking of that where that's still not the case?
Well, so I think the major part we just said was data validation. We've never been able to really do this effectively or scale this because there was really, again, no kind of tooling to say, let me pull the semantic model into another tool and then create some automation. The only way was a report level or a thin report. I can now treat a semantic model as a data frame. I can now pull that in any way I would normally do with Jupyter Notebooks, which is how much we usually do a data validation. That's, I think, the core way. I think the second core we're going to see is for all those data scientists out there. Because what are they, the joke is 80% of the time that data scientists work on or whatever, they work 80% of the time on data cleaning. I can give you clean data now, right off the bat. All the outliers, the right metrics that you have to use, you don't have to recreate that. And further, you're using the business data as already specified because we've already created the dimensions that have been validated. We've already created the measures that we use in our reports. So what you're using, I'm using. And that is integral rather than them having to start with their own raw data.
But it's not a replacement.
Replacement for what?
For their existing data sources.
I mean, like why would it?
Well, I mean, so there's a couple of things. One is I would hope that, like, ideally, you're providing your gold layer level data. Like, it's curated, it's shaped, it's sourced from the same place that's going into the semantic model for data sources that they're pulling into machine learning processes, right? To enhance, okay? I think there is an argument where, hey, having a connection or an understanding of the measures, right? The additional business logic of calculations and grouping and how we're looking at data in a model is very helpful from the same way that it's helpful for us to reach into the model and look at relationships for data verification, right? But I can't take that data set and replace that as my source for all of my data science.
You can now.
You can't, because the very fact of that data set includes the measure outputs. So if I'm building data science against that and I'm needing to enhance data, I'm not using the measures. my enhancement has to be the raw data going into the model itself. So is it useful for analysis? Yes, but it's not useful for like this being a cycle of I can pull from the model, pull back in and shoot through enhancements, because measure like the data sets aren't, they don't exist like that. Like the aggregation layer is in the semantic layer.
So I see your point, Seth, and I agree with you to some degree. I will also think, I think part of the story here is there is business logic buried in that model anyways. And I do think there's some use case where there depends on what kind of machine learning or AI stuff you want to do, right? So if you need all the raw data, probably not a good place to go to the model. You're probably looking at a lake to go get the stuff from. However, if we're doing some very basic predictive things or some, you know, correlation things across some pieces of the model, I do think there's actually a very solid use case for picking a handful of dimensions from the model and to pick a couple of measures, produce a large table of data, and that becomes used to show correlations. There's some predictive things about year, weekly, monthly, maybe by product. So
sure, but if
some
you're
of that
only,
stuff I think is used there.
If you're only using the table information from the Semantica model, mm-hmm. that should be accessible to you in the back end.
Yes, I would agree. I agree with that. It should be available to you in the back end. But do you want to, if I'm building systems that will consume from the model and potentially go back into the model, right? My mind is thinking is, look, someone's tasked me with doing some predictive things off of this model. We want to do some forecasting or some maybe, you know, projections around by product, by region, something like that. It'd be really nice to have a model have all that in it and then be able to do the data science, use semantic link to go get the data, produce the table, produce the forecast, and then, you know, basically update a table that the model can then go refresh itself and then use. So I do think potentially there's a round robin exercise here of, you know, model publish, get data out, do some things, push it back into the model, and then there's a separate page that's doing some sort of predictive things with it. I think it's going to exist. People will want to build it. Not arguing that's the right way to do everything. So I think my
point is this. I think the semantic model is still the end. I think like if you look at the beginnings of the article, like. What's always important to me with a lot of these features is understanding what the use case is, because like there's so many that I could be like, who'd you build this for? And it states, by bridging this gap, we aim to empower business analysts to utilize modern data tools with their data, enable Power BI developers to streamline automation tasks and facilitate seamless collaboration with data scientists. I think there's the analysis part of this and understanding what the end state of things is hugely important and valuable, right? I love the fact that you can plug into this thing so that all these groups now have a clear understanding of the last layer of business logic. And that's what the semantic layer is. Like the data sets that we're building for the business include that last layer of filtering, measure, you know, like calculations that's being presented to them that is otherwise obfuscated in the whatever layer you're pulling from. And that is extremely valuable. So as I'm developing something as a data scientist or whatever, I now have that full link and I can say, hey, I'm plugged into the gold layer. We're doing these things. I'm going to output this confidence level or whatever the case may be. This is going to get interjected into the model. And even to your point, Mike, I can push this into a test model and I can see what that does to the measures and the calculations and everything end to end. So I have a full cycle of deployment where there's no longer this ambiguity or this like trade-off between the teams, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that I'm using this semantic link as a pushback through of data. And that's my point.
And I see what you're saying, because there's kind of the two cases of data science that I think you were on one side, I'm on the other. There's the ad hoc analysis, but then there's also data science enhancements like lead quality. You're going to probably want that in your model. That's exactly the point I was talking about. Okay, so that's part of the automation. I was on the scale of I can do a lot of general forecasting or starting off using some of our already original business data. But yeah, now the nice things we already have the notebooks and lakehouses to do that. But I see exactly
ad hoc analysis. Mm-hmm. That's my point of this. Semantic link in my mind opens the door for like game changing analysis. Why I'm drawing that line in the sand, at least cognitively in the argument here, is because I don't see this as another data source after into feeding something else.
I don't.
And that's what I think the confusion around some of that wording was when you were pushing that point.
So I agree with you, Seth, there, but I get the feeling that Microsoft doesn't really want to limit you in that space. Like I think there's going to be, regardless of, I think there's going to be a need or at least a request to say, I want to pull stuff from the model and I want to do data science on that. Now, should we? Debatable. I think to your point, Seth, I think a proper data scientist or proper analysis of things should be going after the raw data or the silver data or even groomed tables in gold that are doing something that are preparing it for you. So to your point, Seth, like if you're doing proper design, yeah, that stuff should exist. But if we're not doing that, so one of the things that was announced at Fabric Conference was if you have an import model from random things, import models now living in Fabric can be queried right through the lake. So the lakehouse will then take those imported tables and put them back into the model. So potentially there's other things here where I'm doing potentially other data engineering things. There's potential departments that are doing weird stuff with their, you know, do you want to own that? Probably not. But as a data scientist, I may want to at least tap into the data and say, hey, we're going to do some experiments around this information. Does it seem like we could actually get some value out of this and do some predictive things? Cool. Now I've got a whole plethora of tables in, you know, from existing models or other places that don't technically exist. And maybe that's it. Maybe that model is what IT owns and they're not going to expose the raw tables under the hood to data scientists. But the business unit has someone who has a need there. And there may be a servicing mechanism of that model gets serviced to that data and that data scientist to do some things. Yes. I don't know how strong that use case is. I don't know how, again, I have not done, I've played with it. I can get data out, but I have not worked with a data scientist to say, does this add value to you? I can't speak exactly to that point, but I think people are going to ask for it and want to do it.
Well, and I'm not closing down the conversation. I think it's the right back or writing into a model of things that you would do that is like fundamentally just not there and right. would be really complicated to do. But I think that opens also another door of, okay, we're building semantic models to serve reporting for the business. Does it have all the data required that a data scientist would need to do X thing or enhance it in such way? And if not, what am I now talking about? I'm now talking about introducing more data into a semantic model for the purposes of these downstream things and bloating my models to be a source as opposed to the destination for final business logic.
I'm going to be really devil advocate here for a moment because you just said something that triggered a lot of other thoughts in my mind. I'm getting really excited here. You just mentioned write back and we've never had write back before in any model. I mean, granted, but now with models that live on top, like, so I'm getting, again, I'm still spitballing my mind here.
Could you update the model, the source data with whatever enhanced data?
So let's think about Direct Lake, right? I've got a model sitting on top of a lake house. The Direct Lake is working. So that means that data is technically up to date and refreshed within a couple minutes, essentially, right? There's still refreshing happening, but you can turn it on manually, all that kind of fun stuff. You could use model running, pull data from model, write data back down to lake house, and that's a table that exists. You're either adding rows or appending data into it. You could build a process that notebook does some things, processes some data down. And I'm even thinking here, Tommy, my mind goes to the table.
Then you do and develop a measure that produces that.
Yeah,
it's
all of that is possible. So you potentially could go into the model, create some data. You could even put a button on the report that says trigger this that would then run the notebook at this time. So you could literally say, oh my gosh, my mind's blowing up.
Wow.
We have a model with a button you select some things on a table, you could say go, and then it would say produce some sort of calculation. It would then be able to use input parameters from the model or whatever you're trying to do there. That all could be sourced as data points. You could run the notebook. The notebook could complete rows of data, write that back to Lakehouse, and then in a short amount of time, the notebook could even refresh the individual table that you just changed, not the whole model. So you have a faster round robin of write back that could occur with lakehouses. So this is also something, I mean, I'm thinking this from a notebook and what we're doing here from semantic, yeah. Synaptic Link.
Semantic
Link. I'm going to get it right one of these times. Semantic Link. But this could also be a new mechanism for us to actually use a proper write back from a report
you're
back
assuming
into Lake
you can
at some
write,
point.
You're assuming you can write into those tables directly.
If my data without in the lake
well, that's what Direct Lake does. Direct Lake, you're writing the tables that are lake. In the model are the tables that are in the lake.
But you're reading.
Yeah. Okay. So if I have semantic link, I'm reading the model, which is again some of the tables already.
From
you can do those enhancements and then just push back to the.
Yeah, I'm familiar that the back end of all this is Delta tables, right? But where is a use case been that I can write directly into the table that is the source for
you're
a model?
You don't need to write into the table for the model because everything is so fast. You just write back to the lakehouse and the lakehouse just handles all the downstream everything for you automatically. So you don't even touch the model. It's literally the model servicing the data. You're doing some things, you're writing back to the lakehouse. And then in the semantic link notebook, you're saying, hey, here's the table I just wrote data to. Don't refresh the whole model. Just refresh that one table in Direct Lake. You can do that. And then we can then have that one table appear fresh. And then the model within, you know, call it a minute or two or less, can have a, you know, it can be completed and the data can be updated. So that's a very interesting round robin use case that could potentially be utilized here. Testing needs to ensue.
Like, I'm a little worried because this is the second time today you and I have had the same thought at the same time.
Yeah, we must be drinking the same kind of coffee.
I'm glad it's you two, because if I was synced with Tommy, I don't know what I would do. It's interesting. Yeah, it would be interesting.
I think this is worthy. So you heard it here first on the Explicit Measures podcast, a round robin loop from semantic link all the way back to model back into reports. So I mean, Tommy, this sounds to me like we need to mock up a demo and do a little learned fabric around how this cyclical pattern of, like, you know, use, you know, semantic link, get data out, do something with it, potentially write back to model, and then see that data appear in the report would be kind of cool. That'd be interesting.
We need to do that demo for us and for some of my clients who are doing data science. They're like, listen, we love to use Power BI, but we're using our own data because we can't. Literally, we've heard we can't actually use, like, whatever models they're using, we can't use. So
yeah, correct. Point. We're over time. I think this has been a full hour of things. So I like this thing. Let's do final thoughts here. So semantic link, some final thoughts. Seth, what's your kind of final thoughts or wrap up thought here around semantic link?
Love the analysis aspect of it. There are some significant immediate use cases. The fact that we can reach into the model and pull out measures and the like lineage views of things, I think is going to speed up development. Tons of different verification data quality things. And who knows, you guys may prove me wrong and there might be a write back case here. And a huge conversation once again around the data science aspects of semantic link.
I don't think that. Yeah, go ahead, Tommy. Your final thoughts.
I want to speak to the other 70% of users who may feel intimidated by Python or Jupyter notebooks right now, because for this whole conversation, you're going either oh no or a lot of Googling. Listen, there's a learning curve. Not saying that learning curve is not worth it, though. There are so many sources to get started. If you are feel intimidated by Jupyter notebooks or Python notebooks or whatever it is in Fabric, just get started. If you already have Copilot, just begin that process. And I would encourage to start it now.
There actually is, I mean, I would say this also too. There is some really good documentation from Microsoft. There are some really good tutorials. There's also a lot of partner workshops coming out recently. So Microsoft has a lot of partners of Microsoft going out and doing like Fabric in a Day, learn how to do Fabric. I'd highly recommend do those experiences. Go find some of those. There's a lot of really good experiences around those kind of items, because that'll really, again, you need to dedicate yourself some time. You need to pull yourself away from your normal workflow. go in, build the objects that you need, and see how easy it is to get some of this stuff started. I think that will then immediately start reducing some of your angst around your agita around all those pieces around using notebooks. There you go, Tommy. That was for you, bud. There you go. My first Italian word right there. I'm not a good Italian. I don't know my words as much as I should.
Perfect.
All right, perfect. All right, good. Good use of the word. All right. My final thought here is I think this opens up a lot of possibilities. You will need to find what patterns work for your organization. I believe there will be trade-offs with the ability to write back from semantic link into models and things like that as well. But there, I think, again, this is why I love the Power BI community, and particularly the now Fabric community, I guess I should call it. There's a lot of people trying to figure this stuff out. There's a lot of examples getting shown. There's people doing YouTube videos on this. There's people showing and you know, giving you patterns here. So take this as an education moment. And I can't stress enough how important it is for you to work with your boss, your leaders, your people, to give you some time to discover and work on new things. Because there's a lot of things coming. And it's going to be an experience where I think people need to continue to invest in it, because it's going to get better. This is, Power BI has already changed my career. I see Fabric enforcing my career decision to move towards Power BI, and that's going to be important for a lot of people. Anyways, with that, thank you all so much. We appreciate your time. Thank you for listening for over an hour today. So we've wasted a lot of your time today. We appreciate you. And our only ask is please share this with somebody else if you found this conversation valuable. Tommy, where else can you find the podcast?
You can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to subscribe and leave a rating. It helps us out a ton. Do you have a question, an idea, or a topic that you want us to talk about in a future episode? Head over to powerbi.tips/podcast. Leave your name and a great question. And finally, join us live every Tuesday and Thursday, 7:30 a.m. Central, and join the conversation on all of PowerBI.tips social media channels.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.